everybody. Welcome back to For the Girls. We are so lucky to be joined by another incredible guest. We are here with Bernie Collins today. And most recently, Bernie was the head of race strategy at Aston Martin. And prior to that role, she was a senior strategy engineer at Racing Point, which is now known as Aston Martin, for almost 5 years, and a strategy engineer at Force India. She started her F1 career in the graduate program at McLaren, where she spent 6 years, first as a graduate engineer, a design engineer, and a performance engineer. This past season, she has stepped away from her day-to-day role and is now helping to improve people's understanding of the sport and helping break down barriers, especially for young women in STEM, which we so admire and cannot wait to chat about. But we're so excited to have you here, Bernie. Thank you so much for joining us.
No problem. Thank you for having me. Good introduction.
So, yeah, I'm glad. We can't do you full justice, I'm sure, but hopefully that comes close. So we definitely want to dive into the beginning of your career, but I think first we would just love to start with your most recent role as head of race strategy at Aston Martin. First of all, what an amazing role. Would love to just hear from you what your responsibilities were. What does that role entail?
Yeah, so it was a really incredible role to be fit to take part of and to do as part of the team. And I guess you only really appreciate it when you look back in hindsight, which I've been fortunate enough to do now. But yeah, ultimately the responsibility is just to try and get the best result for the team. You know, the team totally operates on team points across both drivers. So for sure, each driver is trying to get the best result individually, but you're trying to get the best overall result for the team and hopefully the most points over the year. Now in the race, that breaks down to really simple things like choosing a pit stop and how you react to certain events, but over the whole weekend you're looking at how you can sort of optimize the car's performance, how you can get, you know, the best qualifying position or the best race position or the best tire choice for the weekend. So there's quite a lot that builds up to the last bit of the race, if you see what I mean.
So would you be kind of sitting on the pit wall? How did you manage everything in the garage with so many moving parts, so many people trying to make decisions?
Yeah, so primarily you would sit on the pit wall during the sessions, the race weekend. You'd be in, you know, a truck, an engineer's truck in the paddock the rest of the time. So outside of the sessions, we had a lot of your meetings. Then you had a lot of support from the factory. So the factory is based in the UK, but it operates on the same time zone as we are wherever we are in the world. So you have a lot of conversations with the rest of the team back there. So generally there's one person at the track from the strategy department, which is generally me or another. And then you'll have sort of 3 to 4 people on support full time back at the factory. So there's a lot of like conversations that goes on, a lot of meeting that goes on to try and make sure like everyone's working on the same page and you're all sort of doing is getting as much done as you can, but without repeating any of the tasks or anything. But just trying to bring all the information that you have together and hopefully make the right decisions from the track side point of view.
It sounds like you have to do a lot of things really fast, real time, constantly for that.
Yeah, I think like it's, you know, everyone thinks of the real hectic like in session stuff, and that is sure, you know, like single lap decisions that you're trying to make really quickly. You're trying to decide before the end of the lap if you're going to box or not, maybe react to something that's happened quite close to the end of the lap. You do a lot of like preparation in advance, so a lot of thinking of if there was a safety car now, what would I do, etc. But a lot of maybe what people don't see is at the end of a Friday night or the end of a Saturday night, when you've got a little bit more information about your tires or about the car pace, or the end of Saturday when you've got your qualifying positions, that period when, you know, the punters have all gone home and the stands are getting really quiet, that's actually really probably one of our busiest periods, because you're trying to get all the information together, do all the analysis from what happened during the day, and then formulate a plan for the next day. And you're trying to do that all sort of, you know, as quickly as you can, just that everyone gets home and gets some rest. So there's lots of like different levels of busyness. There's like the panic busyness of the pit wall, and then there's like sort of more structured analysis busyness of what you're trying to do after that.
And I know a lot of race weekends, like random wrenches can be thrown in and things that you can't predict, but how much would you say race strategy depends on like what you've prepared for, all the things that you just said, and how much ends of it just being like on the fly decisions during the race?
I think a lot of it, like most of the stuff that is like So you have a plan, you know, like a plan A, like this is exactly when we would want to stop if nothing was in our way type thing. And you very rarely end up on that plan. So it's always like something that happens, an accident, so you have to car all those things. But we spend a lot of time, like you suggest, you know, preparing in advance. What's the risk of a safety car? What laps are they likely to be? What's the risk of it raining or there being an accident or all these things? So you've got lots of like alternative plans. And I described it recently to someone as, you know, even from the outside, when you watch a very boring one-stop race where it looks like we've only made one decision, actually we've made hundreds of decisions in the background that are never actually used. So every lap we're discussing, what if now, like what if there's a safety car? What if we get a puncture? What if we have front wing damage? So all these times and all these other laps where from the outside it's like nothing's happening, we're still making like loads and loads of decisions all the time just to be ready in case something does happen. So it's really, I'd say the preparation is much more key than the on-the-spot decisions generally.
And in terms of, obviously you have to be looking at what everybody's doing, not just your drivers, not just your team, but you have to be looking at all other teams. Do you have a team that's looking at everybody else or a team that's just looking at, you know, Aston Martin? And how do you bring that all together? Like, what's the balance of looking at yourself versus looking at others?
Yeah, so I think I'd say most of the teams in the pit lane have a really similar structure where you've got one person generally on the pit wall making overall decisions. Then back at the factory, you'll have someone looking specifically at your own car. So they'll be looking at one driver or the other, and they'll be looking at their lap times and their exact race. And then we have people who are just devoted to competitor analysis. Mm. So at the moment, which I think maybe isn't commonly known, is in the pit lane, we get the pit wall to driver communications for all the other teams. So live in the race, we can hear the conversations that are going on with the other drivers. You obviously don't hear, you know, the private conversations happening on the pit wall, but you do hear 18 other conversations. So we have people that listen to that in the factory, as do all the teams, and sort of try and pick out the important bits, tell us what they've gathered or what they think they're going to do next or think they're close to pitting and stuff. So there's a lot of, you know, there's a big devotion. I think it's growing the amount that teams are spending just on competitor analysis, looking at like where they're strong, where they're weak, you know, even really like simple things like we can now do like GPS overlays. So you can look at another competitor and see that they're saving their energy, and therefore you know in a few laps that they're going to spend that energy. So it's become like quite tactical,
so cool.
You know, what you can do.
That is so cool. And what was your relationship like with the race engineers when you're kind of in this position? Are you hearing from the factory and then telling them then what to say to the drivers, or kind of how does that all come together?
Yeah, so generally, like, I think again, most teams, the line of communication is really similar. So you tend to have a decision being made centrally, then go into the race engineer, then the race engineer talks to the driver. So that's sort of the line of communication generally. We try to have like one voice for each sort of aspect. So the people in the factory will speak to me, we'll make a decision, then I'll speak to the race engineer. And that's sort of the flow of it. And the way that that normally happens is that the driver only hears one voice. So he only hears from the race. He's not hearing like all of this confusion or everything that's going on in the background. You need to have a pretty strong relationship with the race engineers in many ways, because they need to trust what you're saying is going to be, going to be correct. And a lot of it's just like afterwards, if you do make a mistake or something goes wrong, you go through it and you analyze it and you learn a little bit together and you build a bit of trust with each other.
Yeah.
And what about that relationship with the drivers? Like, how much are you working with them before the race, during the race? And I know, you know, you worked with Seb and Lance. So any insights on what it was like working with them would be so cool.
Yeah, I think you spend a lot of time, like, again, mainly Saturday night, Sunday morning. Like, that's the point where it's quite funny. Like, at the start of the weekend, Thursday or Friday, when they're thinking of their car setup and they're thinking about what happened last week, they're not so interested in what the strategy guy or girl has to say. And then as you get closer to Sunday, the conversations with you become, like, more and more apparent. But, you know, Seb, I think everyone knows, is very, like, into his strategy. He's very like particular about everything. He's very like on top of all of the small details that go into his race weekend. And it was a bit like daunting almost when he joined the team, because you're a bit like, oh, how much feedback am I going to get on the strategy decisions we make or whatever. But yeah, he was really keen on a Saturday night or Sunday to sit down and go through all the plans. Or we do like a lot of like simulating of what we think might go wrong or might go right or what others might do. And he'd always have a bit of a, oh, what if XYZ does this? Or like, because his history in F1 is much more than my history in F1, he'd sometimes say things like, oh, have you looked at the race in whatever year it might be? I was like, no, I haven't looked at that race, but I will go and look at that race.
So wow, some so examples. Would remember back to specific races from like 10 years ago. Wow.
That's incredible.
Yeah, so he would just say like, oh, look at this race when we did XYZ. It's like, oh, okay. And then Lance was always much more like on board with what you were suggesting, would just sit and go through the stuff that you were working through with him. So you end up with like a very different relationship across the drivers. And just in terms of, you know, just people are different, so they'll want different pieces of information at different times. But again, it's just about over the time that you've been there, building trust with them so that when you do make a decision or you do say this is the plan that you want to do or this is the reason why we think something might work or not work or whatever, that gradually over time they learn to go, oh, okay, well, you know, she's probably thought through all of the options or yeah, so like there was sometimes they thought I was right or wrong or whatever, but then you just go through it afterwards and, you know, if you're wrong, you explain why you made that decision at the time or what information you might have, they could have given you that would have been different that would have helped that. So you start to really build on how you work together. So yeah, it was always good fun.
That is so cool. And during a race, how much are you guys listening to drivers on the track? I know there were instances last year on other teams of like drivers quote unquote calling their own strategy and things like that. Yeah. Like how much are you listening to drivers and their radios and taking into consideration what they think is right
in
the moment?
Yeah, I think the biggest time that like obviously you take into consideration as much as we've got loads of data and we love to make decisions as engineers based purely on the data, that's often doesn't quite cover everything that's happened. So like, you know, the classic cases when the tires are going off a little bit and you can't quite see it in the lap times yet, or you're stuck in traffic so your lap times can't show you how good or bad a state the car is in, so you need to rely on the driver to sort of say, I think I can go, you know, 4 tenths faster, 5 tenths faster. And then you need to sort of know your driver to know how realistic that 4 or 5 tenths is, and actually if you should be thinking 1 or 2 tenths. So it really, again, you know, you take different pieces of information from different drivers in the same way you would anyone that you work with in an office, because you know a little bit about them. The biggest one then is sort of the wet or dry situation. So when a track's getting drier and you think it's time to go for a dry tire, you sort of need to rely a lot on the driver's feeling in that instance. You can give them information about other drivers for sure and sort of encourage the conversation, but definitely, you know, it's up to them to sort of, or to a good degree, to decide, yeah, now it's time for a dry tire. And that's the biggest one for me. But you know, we had a lot of conversation, and the difficult one is when stuff needs to happen really quickly, so you need to, you're really close to the pit lane entry, you need to make a really quick decision, it just needs to be a call. Those are really hard conversations. We've not had a chance pre-making a decision to really discuss it. But yeah, we were quite open at listening to our drivers, I think. And you do get some really good feedback. Like they are the one sensor in the car, if you like, that sets you apart from all of the other cars on track. So you sort of need to know that they're correct and take on board what they're saying.
What would you kind of find to be personally the most challenging for either planning in advance or these on the fly decisions, like either the inters or slicks decision, or when there's really unexpected safety cars or just general chaos? I can think of a few races
general
this year
chaos
things got really crazy really quickly, and there were so many jokes this year of Ferrari saying like, oh, we're on plan E.
I never got to plan E, or at least I never had a plan E written down, because nobody, like the drivers, can't remember that far, really.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think it's the stuff where you need to make really quick decisions where it could go either way. Often in the wet or dry, especially if you're going if it's a dry in track, things actually happen reasonably slowly. It dries lap on lap, so it's like a very gradual thing. If you get like sudden rainfall, then it's quite a quick decision, but often it's really clear what you should be doing. Sometimes it's the safety cars at the end of the race where you're trying to say, oh, we might lose some positions. You're trying to second guess what everyone else is doing, and you're then committing the driver to have to overtake some people and make that strategy work. Those are the ones that are often the most difficult, and difficult for a number of reasons, because it's very close to the end of the race often, so it's very, you don't have enough time to make up for the decision again as well later on. So there's an element of that, but there are always ones where it's really obvious afterwards what you should have done. So like straight away someone's like, oh, we're never going to overtake, or that tire was always going to be okay, or whatever it might be, but not information that you had at the time. So I find those ones were probably the most hectic, where there's a lot of decisions that are really 50-50. And you go through them in hindsight and you try and learn and, you know, improve your decision making going forward. But yeah, those are ones where there's always quite strong opinions from everyone involved.
I'd love to talk a little bit about your role and like what it was like being a traveling member of the team. I'm sure this year you're going to be really happy, or have been happy, to not do all of the traveling. But what was that like for you, like day in the life of being a traveling team member and constantly being on the road?
Yeah, so I think like it's easy to pick up on the negatives of it. Like, you're away from home a lot. It's really tough. The jet lag. There's many things that are quite difficult. Like, depending on where you end up in the world, we tended to sort of travel out on the Tuesday or Wednesday pre-race. So you'd be at the track on a Thursday, and then Thursday to Sunday would be at the track. And like the Friday and the Saturday nights are generally really late. So at the moment we've got like a curfew in place where you need to be away from the track for 8 or 9 hours. But actually by the time you get back and showered and get some sleep, it's not, you know, it's like sort of more like 6 hours sleep type thing, depending again on where you are. And then on Sunday or Monday, we travel back to the UK and we kick off our analysis. So it's pretty relentless in terms of the days that you're working, because you're starting... Yeah, you're starting like the Monday or Tuesday before a race, and then you're finishing like the Wednesday or Thursday after a race. So there's quite a lot of days in a row. And if you do like the back-to-back races where you go straight to the next track, it's like pretty relentless. And we did a few where it was, you know, 3 races in a row across several time zones. And just by like Saturday or Sunday of the last race, you're like, I just need 10 minutes on my own. Because you sort of end up in this like... traveling pack that's your family, so you spend more time with these people than you spend at home. And I was really fortunate, and the guys that I worked with at Aston Martin I got on really well with, so you know, they were a really good community. But it just gets to a point where you're like, I just need 5 minutes, like, just, I need my lunch alone, just nobody annoy me, I'm alone,
I need to recharge my battery.
Exactly. Yeah,
that makes total sense. Maybe on like a more positive or fun note, do you have a particular favorite moment or race with the team over the past couple years that you remember, whether that was like a specific call or just like a race in general,
or also just tracks or circuits? Yeah, just kind of your, some of your favorites while you were with the team.
Yeah, I think like, you know, to be positive on the travel and stuff, I love the travel and I love going and seeing like different places in the world, different communities. We often get a real feel for the country. I was very fortunate, you know, pre-COVID to stay out in a few holidays and really get to like sort of embrace the traveling life, which was good. And I wouldn't change that. Best moments, you know, it's really, there's a lot of races where you didn't necessarily have a fantastic result. There's one in Brazil that springs to mind where it was a wet race. And we actually finished fourth, which is a good result for us, but we just missed out on the podium. But it was a race where people were really disappointed we lost the podium, but actually I felt like we made every decision correctly. So from a strategy point of view, I felt like actually that was a really good race. And then you get other races where you feel like you made some really bad decisions, but actually the result's pretty good. I guess the standout moment is we only had one win in my time with the team, and that was with Checo in 2020 in Bahrain. And that was really, you know, it felt like we had just achieved something that people didn't think was possible. Now, there was mistakes from others, but we were still there to pick it up, and we made the right decisions. So that was like a really, especially because it was a time where Cheka was leaving as well, it was a really lovely moment for the team to have felt that win together, which, you know, we'd had a few podiums throughout the years, and it felt like a real step up. So that was brilliant. That was like sort of a highlight, I would say.
That was just an insane race. I think that's one of the highlights of his career for sure. It's just incredible. Yeah. What was it like working with him? Were you surprised by the move to Red Bull?
I wasn't surprised necessarily, because I think with us, he was really underrated. Because he was working for Cindy, he was always scoring the most points in the team, but I think the people he was racing against were a bit underrated, and therefore he was underrated for beating them. So I'm glad that, you know, at that stage, okay, you're not involved in all the conversation that obviously he's involved in, so maybe it wasn't as at risk as it seemed to us. But it felt like he came really close to not having a drive, and he's, you know, a really lovely guy, and works hard. So it was really lovely to get that win and then go on to see him get the Red Bull seat. And then since that, go on to have, you know, performed really well in that seat where others have not. So, yeah, I feel really happy that, yeah, he's had that opportunity. It's really good to see, I think.
We've talked a lot about the number two seat at Red Bull and what it takes to shine in that role. He's definitely killing it.
Spring is here, which means F1 season is in full swing and festival and concert season is just around the corner. No matter where you go, this season will be all about the boots, and Tecovas has got you covered. This spring, they're offering seasonal and limited edition offerings, including boots, apparel, hats, bags, and more. So stop by your local Tecovas store, have a complimentary drink or two, and shop all the new spring styles. Some stores even have leather custom branding and live music and events. It's so fun. And if you can't make it into a store, just visit tecovas.com. That's TECOVAS.com. They offer free shipping on all boots, as well as free returns and exchanges, and will ship right to your door. So go to tecovas.com and find your new favorite pair of boots today.
I thought it would be fun now, maybe we talk a little bit about, we'll go back in time and talk about your start in this wonderful world of F1. So you're from Northern Ireland. Okay. Tell us about your upbringing, your family. Did you guys grow up watching F1? How did you get into it and where you are?
Yeah, it's really, like I grew up when F1 was on the TV, like dad would have watched it at home and stuff. But it was something that, at least when I was younger, it wasn't really highlighted that you could work in it, which sounds a bit silly, but, you know, there's lots of, you know, videos of the drivers or imagery of the drivers or interviews of the drivers, but you didn't really think about the people in the pit lane or the people working in the factories even, or any of that. So I hadn't really imagined ever working in motorsport. It wasn't something, like a lot of people, I get contacted by a lot of people who really want to work on F1, that's all they want to do. And I wasn't one of those people, I just didn't know what I wanted to do. I was always like quite curious as to how things worked or taking things apart, or so I was always quite mechanically minded, which maybe wasn't obvious to others, or maybe it was, but at least it wasn't obvious to me until I got down the path of starting mechanical engineering. But looking back on it now, like I was forever taking things apart to see how they worked. So it was probably always obvious that I was going to be an engineer. It just took a long time to get there.
And so you went to get a master's in mechanical engineering from Queen's University, Belfast.
Yeah,
what was that program like? And then how did you decide, I guess, from there to launch into F1?
Yeah, so I did engineering because I didn't know what to do. And I really enjoyed math and physics. So I was just like, I literally like took the university prospectus and said, I'm doing maths and physics for A-levels. So what sort of degrees can I do? And just like stroked out the stuff that I could do and tried to figure it out. And then that had like the most broadest range of careers at the end of it. So I thought, okay, well, that's fine. I can just kick the decision down the road another little bit. But I really enjoyed my engineering. And then I did a program called Formula Student. So it's like organized by the MIC. We build a little single-seater race car. And that's actually the first time that I thought even about automotive as a career, because in Belfast, a lot of people go into the aerospace industry or the shipbuilding industry, that type, those types of industries. So it was the first time I'd really thought about automotive, racing, that sort of thing. And I enjoyed it just because it's got such a variety. So you use a bit of design work, a bit of build work, a bit of like looking at the manufacturer. So that was really great. And at the end of, coming towards the end of my degree, McLaren advertised a graduate scheme. And I was very much, I'd sort of ruled myself out just because I thought, oh, it's going to be such limited numbers. They were looking for two people. So I'd sort of decided not to go for it. And one of my lecturers encouraged us to apply and said, everyone needs to apply type thing. And I applied and I got through the interview processes. And at each stage, it was just like, oh, let's see how it goes. And you get to the final interview, which you go to McLaren. And you think, well, at least I get to see around McLaren. If nothing else, I've got to see around McLaren. So that's, tick box. So it was really great because I think a lot of people have the attitude that they're maybe not good enough or it's not worth their while applying. And actually, that was my first real insight to, you need to put yourself forward and you need to go for these opportunities that exist. So I joined, I was really lucky to join that McLaren scheme. There was two of us taken on that year purely into F1. So we did a one-year graduate scheme in F1 in loads of different departments, which, graduate schemes are really great for that. It really built my confidence to see how the whole team worked together, how all the departments worked together. You get to meet loads of people and, it's really nice. And yeah, then I ended up working for them as a designer, which again was a great opportunity to sort of sit in the design office and work through it.
So it sounds like maybe you didn't fully envision yourself at McLaren until you were very close to actually being there. When you got there, yeah. Was there something super surprising about either the team or just the world of F1 that you weren't expecting?
I think one thing that surprised me when I got there is they've obviously got this massive design office with, really super intelligent guys and girls in there that have been working for a long time. Some of them have been working their whole lives in F1 with loads of experience. And I think what surprised me is the time that they were prepared to devote to helping me. So there was lots of guys that were clearly very busy that would sit down and explain things to me or go through design stuff with me. Or it felt like everyone had time and everyone was willing to help me on my journey rather than just their own little busyness. So it was a real team atmosphere compared to an office where everyone's trying to get their bit done as quickly as possible and get home. Everyone was trying to work together and knew that, making me a stronger engineer would ultimately help the office. So I think that sense of community I wasn't expecting. I was expecting it to be a bit more cutthroat than that. And actually it was really a nice environment to step into.
That's so nice to hear.
And when you were transitioning to working in performance engineering, what was that like? How was kind of taking that step up? What drivers did you work with?
Yeah, so that was really, like when I got to the F1 stuff, I ended up with McLaren doing gearbox design. And through that time, I sort of, they had a GT program. So they had a road car basically that they were racing in and wanted some help with. So I volunteered for that. I got some trackside experience. And when I was at the track, I thought, actually, I really enjoy this aspect of it. I sort of want to do the racing bit. I want to be at the track. So I ended up volunteering for the F1 team, like helping out in their mission control and doing a variety of little things, but all sort of promoted me towards the performance engineering position. So it was quite a step away from gearbox design. But again, there was a lot of support there to try and help me learn what I needed to do for the performance bit and like make the move across. And then I was given the opportunity, one of the guys went on paternity leave and I stepped into his role for two races, and it was really great, like stepping stone and a chance to do it. So I did the 2014 season with Jenson Button. Wow. So I did that whole year there with
them.
Amazing. Yeah,
so that is so cool. Really,
and again, like that was really lovely because, he knew I was learning and it was my first year doing it. But again, really supportive, and trying to explain, he had a lot of experience at that stage, still does. I don't know why I said at that stage, but he was really like helpful in trying to teach me what he needed to get, again, that sort of strength in trying to strengthen the whole team. So yeah, it was a really brilliant experience to do the full season racing with those guys. And yeah, lovely to work with Nance. It was good.
Yeah, he's one of my favorite ex-drivers around in the sport. I think he's incredible.
He's crushing it these days.
Yeah, he is. I expect no less. That's amazing. Okay, so then you were a performance engineer, and then how did you make the jump to strategy? So what was that step
yeah,
like?
Yeah, so it was really, like, I feel like a lot of my career moves haven't been really planned out, and I've just sort of, like, happened, which, you know, everyone asks about your five-year plan, but I don't think you necessarily need to have one of those.
I love that.
So I moved to Force India, as it was then, and I moved, and actually the role that I moved to was like half performance, half strategy. And as I got there, the guy that was doing strategy left. So as I arrived, they were like, well, actually now it's just going to be pretty much all strategy. I was like, well, I've not done strategy before, but okay.
tossing you right in.
Yeah, exactly. It was like, but I think it was more like out of need than anything. You know, they'd recruited me to help out that role, so it was a bit like, I think I had like two events where the strategy guy was still there. They had another strategist as well, so there was two events where the person I was replacing was still there, and then he left, and I was like, oh my god, like, this is mental. But I think because it's a small team, they, like, it was out of need, you know. And I had loads of support from the people around me, and, you know, the full-time strategist, you know, the two of us worked really well together. But it's an opportunity you wouldn't be given in a bigger team, because it's just crazy. But yeah, it was a really good step for me, I think. And it was like, because I'd seen some of it before at McLaren, and you've got like a little bit of experience and you build up some race knowledge. At least in hindsight, I feel like it was okay, but maybe at the time it was terrible. So yeah, it was, that just became me as a strategist then, when I started, when I moved to Force India, and then I've only done strategy since then. So yeah, I've enjoyed it, and you've definitely learnt a lot about a very different field to what I was necessarily doing before. So yeah, it's been cool.
And working for, going from McLaren to then transitioning to Racing Point, and also kind of Racing Point undergoing changes in leadership and transitioning to Aston Martin, did you notice kind of any big differences between the teams, or kind of what was the dynamic like during all of that?
Yeah, so like McLaren's at that stage was a much bigger team than Force India. So he sort of rocked up at a very different factory. It was so much smaller. You're sort of looking around the design office going, where is everybody else? Like, and I just remember being blown away by how few people there were in the design office versus McLaren. And you then start to think, were we just being really inefficient, or, you know, why is there so few of them? So that was interesting. As well as that, I was like, in the race engineering department that I was then part of, with the strategy team, you got so few people, it really prioritized what you worked on. You had to work on really important things and be really flexible with what you were prioritizing and what you were working on now. But actually, as a move, it was really great for learning, because there wasn't somebody for each job. It was like, just pick up the next most important job and get on with it. So you were given loads of opportunities, and I worked on a load of different roles that I wouldn't have had in a bigger team. So yeah, it was quite nice. And then I guess gradually over time, Force India have merged through the different names to, you know, now be quite a big team. So it's probably ended much closer to what the McLaren days were like, but much like gradually over time. So I've sort of not realized the transition so much.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I'm curious your thoughts on Aston Martin today and in the future. I know there's a lot of news and people talking about how much the Strolls in Aston Martin is investing in an amazing future. Are you optimistic about that? Does that, and Alonso joining the team too?
Yeah, I think, well, so I'm really interested to see how Alonso does.
And me both.
You know, and, yeah, because I think, you know, everyone really rates him as a good driver. I've never worked with him, but, you know, just to see how fast the car is out of the box, how well he gets on with the team, you know, I think he'll fit in with the team. It's just be interested to see the speed, basically. In terms of like the going forward, Aston Martin, from where we were, I keep saying we still, but you know, from where they were, I think the investment's been huge and the management of it so far is going reasonably okay. Like, it's really difficult to take on like a whole new factory and a lot of new people and make them all work together, but so far I think that's gone okay. And the team before were really good and worked really hard and got really good results from the car that they had. So if we can just make this transition phase into the new factory and the new wind tunnel, then it should be a really strong team. There's obviously difficulties in the team growing so much and all of these things, but yeah, I am quite hopeful. You know, it's felt sad in a way to have gone through the period where we didn't have a particularly nice factory, like showy factory, or you know, we didn't have, you know, an amazing office or whatever, and you leave and this new factory is being built and you know everything's going to be shiny and new and there's going to be a nice new canteen and a nice new gym and stuff, and you're like, why am I leaving now? You know, I've done all the hard bit. So I think that the new the new factory and stuff will be really powerful for the team. And you know, the Alonso and Lance dynamic will be interesting to see going forward as well, and hopefully that's all okay. But yeah, I feel like I was treated really well there, so I'm hopeful for the team and the guys that are still there that it all works out okay.
Yeah, and even if you don't get the shiny canteen, you were there for the come up and you helped build the foundation for the future, which
is so legit.
Great.
Yeah, what is the, knowing the Strolls, do you have any predictions on kind of what the dynamic with Alonso will be, or how is kind of the partnership between Lance and Vettel? Was that ever hard to manage?
I don't think it was hard to manage because they're both at very different stages of their career. So, you know, Lance is just trying to absorb as much information as he can, and both with, you know, Sebastian and now Alonso, he'll have... There's such, I have in my head that they're going to be quite different characters, like Sebastian and Alonso, but he's got loads of different opportunities to learn, like a very different technique or a very different style with his engineers or whatever it might be. So yeah, I think at the minute, like, Lance is just absorbing all of that information and trying to learn as much as he can, so I don't think there'll be any friction between them. And apart from, you know, the one year that we had Checo and Esteban, generally the team and the driver dynamics have been really good. So I've not had to live through too much of, you know, the infighting. I'm pretty hopeful that that'll all be good. And you know, a lot, Lance will just learn loads.
Yeah. Sort of on a similar topic with Vettel leaving and retiring, I know, I think you left before he officially retired, but his radio message to you, I think it was the Hungarian Grand Prix, was so sweet at the end of the race. What was it like being a part of the team with him sort of on his way out and working with him? I know you spoke a little bit about it earlier, but in the context of retirement.
And what was it like getting a radio shout out by a
person for a start? But like, I think that was because I've been giving him so much abuse. So I was leaving the Hungary Grand Prix, and I had 6 months' notice. So it was known for 6 months that I was leaving at that race. And then at that race, he announced his retirement. So suddenly all the focus is back on him again. So I was giving him a lot of abuse for stealing my thunder, which I think is why the radio message came. But yeah, it was interesting to see. Like, he'd obviously not decided until quite late, I think, that he was going to leave. He obviously has his own reasons for doing so. I totally get that, but he was still really devoted to what he does, and I think that's a bit unusual in other sports, or you know, whatever. Even stuff like in Hungary, I was still on the pit wall. I was still trying hard to get the best result for the team, even though I knew I wouldn't be there the next week, or I wouldn't have to justify my decisions. And it's a bit like that with Seb. You know, he was still working really hard. He was still suggesting new ideas. He was still like suggesting different bits of analysis we could do. So. I think those guys are, still pushing really hard, even though they have decided. Like, I sort of hope that, for example, with me, and I can't really compare it, obviously it's totally different, like Sebastian even, but in my last 6 months doing my role, I enjoyed it so much because I knew that, or, you know, you think that's going to be your last 6 months. So you sort of say, I'm going to go to every race. I'm going to try and enjoy it as much as I can. I'm going to try and take as many pictures as I can. I'm going to take the time to stop in the pit lane and speak to someone that I'd normally rush past because I'm busy or whatever. So you always end up, or I always felt like I ended up really busy, like running around or getting to the next meeting or whatever it might be, and not really taking time to enjoy it, like not taking a picture of the podium or whatever it might be. So I sort of hope that, you know, similarly for Sebastian, in his last 6 months, he went, okay, I'm going to really enjoy every session, every qualifying, every race, you know, the build up, whatever it might be, the people. And I'm sure you'll see him back in the paddock again, for, you know, whatever he ends up doing. But I hope he enjoyed it. I hope he sort of enjoyed the last 6 months, and sort of it makes you remember that it is really special to work in the paddock, because you can get like, you just, everyone you work with, everyone you know works in the paddock, like you're surrounded by the paddock all the time, so you get like numb to it. And then it's only when you realize actually people would die to be in the paddock. Like, people love the idea of people in the paddock. People would give so much to be there. And you know, my last race, I don't normally go to the grid because I'm normally on the pit wall looking at the weather conditions stuff. And then my last race, I got to go to the grid, and I was like, you know, so few people have been to the grid and walked on the grid and experienced it. So I think it's only when you when you're leaving, which sounds stupid, it's only really when you're exiting that you think about all those things. So yeah, it's been nice to be fit to enjoy it.
Yeah, well, I'm so glad you at least got that time to savor it, and hopefully Sebastian did too.
Yeah, and we definitely want to get into kind of what you've been doing since, but we have one last question before that. I'd love to know what you think about the cost cap and how that is changing or has already changed kind of dynamics. We've talked about Aston Martin having an awesome new facility and how some teams were kind of disadvantaged compared to other teams. And do you think it actually is helping level out the playing field a bit, or since so many categories of spending are excluded, is it just not making that much difference?
Yeah, I think so. It's not something I spend ages going through all the regulations for. I sort of tried to stay away from it as much as possible because it wasn't my job. But I think, unfortunately, the cost caps really came into its own at the point where we've had a really big regulation change. So whether it levels the playing field or not, I don't think we're going to see straight away, because the big regulation changes spread the playing field straight away again, because naturally the top teams have had more time to devote to their next year's car or whatever. So I think it's going to take a few years to see. I think leveling the playing field is important. But I'm not sure that the cost cap's the right way to do it. I dislike the cost cap for a number of reasons. One, I don't like the idea that, you know, like the Red Bull situation, 12 months later, we're finding out that someone's breached cost cap rules. We shouldn't be deciding the championship. Yeah, exactly. Like 12 months later, we should know yes or no, whatever's happened. Now, I think
I know, F1... I was like, I'm not an accountant, but I feel like someone should have figured this out by now.
Yeah, exactly. Like, if your bank was overdrawn, you probably have figured out by 12 months' time. but and it is because it's a really complex set of rules, and I think, you know, everyone's admitted that they're going to try and do a better job of that going forward. So I think that's, that aspect I dislike. It also sort of, you know, if we think of, again, my own situation, but my reason for leaving is how hectic the seasons has become, you know, 23, 24 races, triple headers, it really takes a toll. And I got to the point where I just thought, this isn't, as much as I love it, it isn't life, you know, I'm ending the season really tired or whatever. And I think that teams are going to have to get to a point where they job share to some account. So you've two people doing a role or whatever it might be. And unfortunately, the cost cap flies in the face of that. So you can't really employ two people to do a role or whatever it might be. Now, you could say, okay, well, maybe they don't buy a new front wing and they have two of you, but the teams are never going to go for that trade-off. So I think they need to come up with some sort of situation that still allows for the team to be looked after. And I'm not saying teams aren't necessarily harming their staff, but I think if we're going to add more and more races going forward, then there needs to be some sort of flexibility there. So, and yeah, it seems like so many things are not included in it, that it's really questionable anyway. But yeah, I get what they're trying to do, and I don't have a better solution. You know, at one stage we had a resource restriction where headcount was restricted. But then you're still getting better teams, paying the big money, whatever. So, yeah, I don't have a solution at the minute that's different to what we've got, but I'm not really sure that what we've got is ideal either.
I'm so interested to see what will happen, and this is kind of a nice segue to our next topic too, because as F1 has gotten so big, so many interesting things are coming up, like sustainability, women in the sport, like all these different things that maybe just weren't talked about before. So the point about sustainability is so true, and like I'm curious to see how they can start to, like, we're all human, you're all human, to figure out how it works. But tell us about your switch. So what have you been up to now and advocating for the sport? We know you've been really involved in women in STEM, which is a huge passion of ours too, so we'd love to hear more about it.
I've just taken a bit of time just to relax a little bit, not so much, but I sort of end up getting involved with things like F1 directly. So I did a series with FOM last year, basically going through some races and explaining the strategy and trying to break down what's sometimes reasonably confusing. Like the midfield races, I think, are reasonably confusing for those that just watch along on TV. Mm-hmm. And you get two breeds, really, of people. You get the people who are watching because they've watched it on Drive to Survive and are just getting into the sport and very new to it. So you've got this, and then you've got the people who want all of the data, like all of the lap times, all of the graphs. So it's really difficult, I think, to deal with both sets of people just from one set of TV coverage. So some of it's trying to explain the strategy better to those people, try and go through what the strategists are thinking. And I think there's been more and more focus over the years on the race strategy or the pit wall compared to just the drivers. So that's really interesting. I've learned it's a bit weird, but when you're at the track or working in a team, you don't really think about how the coverage is formed or how all the people are working together or how like the people at the track are working with the people in London to get the video recording out quite quickly and all of this. So I feel like I've learned a lot about like what's going on in or around the paddock that I probably just ignored before. So that's been cool. And then I've been doing some work, you know, like I did some Sky Any Driven Monday things, again, trying to help a little bit bring an engineering voice really to what's happened over race weekend.
Yeah, which is so huge. Can you explain for people who might not, a lot of our listeners are American, might not know kind of the big deal of Sky Sports Any Driven Monday? Because congrats, that's really amazing.
Yeah, so basically it's like Sky Sports in the UK, they show all of the coverage in the UK. So they do like post-race on a Monday, a sort of analysis of the key talking points, for want of a better word. So I just sort of got involved and tried to explain, you know, a bit like you guys are asking me, like what my opinion was or what I thought happened. Like there was a really interesting one with the Verstappen fuel issue in qualifying, which was Singapore, I think. So I sort of went through, you know, from my past experience, what I think happened there. So that's been really interesting because you now post-race can like listen to what's happened during the race and listen to the TV, and then I'm now one of the person going, oh, that's not what I would have done, but it's really easy post-race to say what you would have done. So that's been interesting. And then, yeah, we've been doing loads of, you know, like this sort of thing, like the podcast stuff or some interviews, some working with some schools. I'm actually going back to my secondary school next week. I'm going to talk to some of the students there about engineering. Because I think when I was younger, there wasn't a lot of focus. Like I went to an all-girls school. There wasn't loads of focus on doing engineering or what you could do afterwards. So we're doing, yeah, I'm doing some sort of fun things like that, which I think I'll be quite nervous standing in front of a room of, you know, 16-year-olds that were once me. That'll be fun, hopefully. I don't get too many difficult questions. there's loads of like sort of interesting little bits going on like that.
So incredible.
We always like to ask people sort of what advice you would have for anyone thinking about entering the sport, thinking about becoming a mega fan, whatever it is, like what advice would you have people who are maybe intimidated by it?
Yeah, I think the best advice that I was given, and I've given it to others, is sort of what I explained at the start, like my life would be so different if I just hadn't applied for that McLaren role. So you just need to go for the opportunities. You need to apply for things, put yourself out there, take a bit of a risk. And if you don't get the job or the interview or whatever it is, you need to ask why, like what skills could be different, what could you learn different, what experience you would have. And then I think when we're all younger, especially at the start of career, we end up working really hard to get different experience. Like I did loads of extra weekends at the track to get the trackside experience or to sort of move my job role when the opportunity came up. So it's just about like really putting yourself out there. Like there's loads of junior teams or racetracks or karting or whatever that want people to help out. Like just go along and make cups of tea if that's what it needs to be, but like to get yourself experience, to get yourself out there, get yourself involved with the team. So it's just about trying to take opportunities when they come and just look for them where you can.
But that is such good advice. Thank you so much. It has been so amazing talking to you. We really admired you, and it was just so amazing to have you. We really appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you so much for having me.